Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's December 19th, 2021, and welcome to episode 248 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to us? Will I ever find...
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and 2021. We are closing out the year. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston. I am joined today by two retro computing enthusiasts, the first of whom is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I'm excellent. It's cold. That was like the abbreviated version of what I normally have to say. Welcome to Canada. Snow and winter has come to Canada, and I don't like it. I voted against it, but I got voted down.
Also joining us from Portland is Earl Evans. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's cold here, too. We got actually our first little bit of snow in Portland. Didn't stick. Temperature's not low enough for it to stick around, but a little bit of fun. It's not metric snow like Carrington has, but...
Imperial snow.
It only stay around if you had hipster snow. You've got to get snow before everybody else. And then you stick with it.
Yes.
Otherwise, you're like, so over snow.
Yeah, there was snow, actually. The first sort of like impressive-ish snow was last night here, too. So everybody's had snow. It's mostly gone or turned to ice, one of the two. But
we got.
I guess I shouldn't talk about cold when I'm talking to folks in Boston and Toronto.
No, you should not.
We don't know what cold is compared to you guys.
Curtis says it's minus 20 C in Saskatoon.
Wow. So
that seems low.
What is it? He wants to know what it is in Toronto. I'll tell you what it's in Toronto. It's not Saskatoon. Move, man. Come here. Send it to the universe. Everybody loves it when we say that.
Right.
Minus 20 is crazy. Yes.
That is
too cold, man. That is too cold.
I grew up in Minnesota, and there it does get pretty cold, and you do get temperatures like minus 20, but it's in Fahrenheit, you know. And people talk about the temperature being like 10 below. That's the sort of the phraseology. It's like something below. Anyway, all right. So we're at the end of 2021. I think this will be the last one that we record while it's still 2021. And so, you know, this would be an opportune time to look back at the gloriousness that was 2021 and sort of...
Yikes.
Here at the end of civilization, we only look back.
I was sort of hoping, you know, that when we ended 2020, that would have been the end of the sort of apocalyptic years. But no, they continue. It might be good, potentially... to the extent that any of this is good, for sort of like home-based, you know, hobby projects, which is kind of what we talk about here. So some people may have had some more opportunities, possibly unwanted, but still possibly used, for doing kind of retro computing things and that kind of stuff. So that was basically the extent of the plan, I think, that we had. So I don't know, anything stand out?
For me, the big standout is I got an iMac G4. I actually picked up and have stuck with a retro computer. And the hardcore minimalist that I am, I'm bothered by the fact that there's a couch behind me. But the fact that I have a vintage computer, like a physical one rather than just virtual, is a change. And I love it, and I still love it. I held out forever to get like the exact model I wanted, the exact configuration. basically the no compromise one. And I'm so happy, especially because no compromise retro computers are still very, very cheap. So it's an excellent hobby. My girlfriend, bingo check, rides horses. So her hobby is like, I'm not supposed to call it a hobby, her whatever, is insanely expensive. And I'm like, people will give me my things for free. Please take this Apple II off my hands. So one of the nice things about being in the vintage computer hobby, I mean, you have to watch that it doesn't overwhelm your house, because you can get so much stuff so cheap. It's very easy to let this hobby like fill your place hoarder style. But I have been delighted with the addition to my little desk family here of my Mac G4. I play games on it all the time. I love the aesthetic of it. It's displaying a little clock thing right now. I adore it. I cannot believe how happy I am with this purchase, and it has sustained happiness. It Marie Kondo's me. It brings me joy every day. Absolutely love it. So it's like the biggest retro computer thing I did was basically pick up a retro computer and play a bunch of games on it. But I played a bunch of games for Eaten by a Groot. So a bunch of the Infocom games we played, I played on that computer, which was super fun. I'm currently playing the last game for Eaten by a Groot. So that's the other thing I did really this year, was continue doing that podcast with Kay Savitz. We have been stuck on the last episode, he and I, or the last game rather, for months and months. It's kicking both our butts, but I am determined that at the end of this year, I will have finished this game. I've basically blocked the time between Christmas and New Year's for that game. If I have to spend 6 days just doing that, then that's what I will do. I am absolutely determined, whether I need a walkthrough or whatever, I'm going to finish that game this year, just to be done with it. Oh my gosh. So those kind of loom as the biggest two things. Got a vintage computer that I still love, played a bunch of Infocom games, and they were awesome. So it was all game-based and made me happy.
That's cool. What is it, public knowledge what that game is?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's Zork Zero.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Zero ability for either K or I to solve these puzzles. I have restarted a couple times. It's enormous. I think it might be procedurally generated, and just nobody's told me that the game just goes on forever, because it just seems to go on forever. And it's very hard, and I thought I'd be better at these things, and it's another freaking Zork game. But last one.
Is that one, is it graphic?
No, but like a lot of the later games, it's got it's not like a graphical, like point and click graphical thing, but it's got some built in stuff and auto mapping and things. So it's late stage Infocom graphics, but not graphics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very cool. Earl, any sort of standout moments from 2021 retro
2021
stuff?
Well, it has been both really slow, and it seems like it went by incredibly quick at the same time. I don't even know how that's possible. But 2021 is kind of like the slow blur, I guess I would say. In terms of standout things about 2021, it seems like it's the year that some shows, and I didn't get to any myself, but some of the other podcasters or people in our circle talked about shows that they went to, physical live shows, as well as some shows that remained virtual. So it was kind of a mix and match this year. I think there was even a little bit of a combination of both, you could argue, because some of the shows that were in person did some live streaming as well. And so it was an interesting year, I think, for vintage retro shows. I guess interesting year for me, too, in that things were pretty hectic around the house and at work. So I didn't have quite the time or energy that I'd hoped in 2021 to mess around with the vintage computer stuff. But the standout moment for me, I think, was getting the dual 8-inch disk drive for the Altair up and running, with significant help from a gentleman named Mike Douglas, who runs a couple of Altair and other S100-related websites. And that was a lot of fun, because when that was all done, I could actually put together an Altair system that didn't have any modern cards in it and would still work. There are modern S100 cards, and there's one that I use pretty frequently, but it was possible to rock it like it was the late 70s completely and play around with, you know, the giant 8-inch drives that you never want to drop on your toe. I haven't, so I don't know that for certain. This is just an educated guess that you don't want to drop
pretty
on
good
your
guess.
Toe.
And you probably want to just leave it as an educated guess.
Yes.
No, I think you got to do it for science.
Got to test this.
All right, hang on. No, I'm not going to do that. What I am going to do is eventually get around to the Retro Challenge project that I didn't finish. I got like one or two blog entries into my Retro Challenge entry and then just kind of trailed off, which I think is fairly typical for yep. a lot of Retro Challenge entrants, sadly. But I still do want to do this. I want to make the Altair control a LED matrix. We were talking about character fonts and stuff earlier, I think before the show started, like 5x7, 8x8, that kind of thing. Well, I've got a neat 8x5 RGB LED matrix, and there's a parallel input-output card in the Altair that you could use to talk to it and make it do things. I just haven't done all that yet, but I want to. So that's one of the things for 2022 that I hope to do in 2021, but didn't. And I think the other thing I want to do for 2022 that was an epic fail in 2021 is to divest some more of my collection. I did in 2021 manage to get rid of some things. I think I might have mentioned that when the Altair haul came in, it was something that you don't say no to. You can't say no to something like that. But when it arrived, Keratin was just mentioning being overwhelmed in your house by stuff. I was overwhelmed, and so I need to get rid of some of it. The stuff that I play with the least, and channeling Carrington even a little further here with the Marie Kondo, stuff that does not give me joy, stuff that sits in a closet and collects dust and somebody else would be having fun with. So
it's easy to forget that a hobby is not an obligation. Like, you're allowed to enjoy a thing and then stop for a while and then come back to it or whatever. You're not like, you haven't been ordered by a court to have your hobby. So you're allowed to change things or change your opinion or whatever. So you got to give yourself that freedom to say, like, I'm not obligated to hang on to this thing. It can be very easy to do. I know a lot of people who have difficulty getting rid of books in particular, and then sometimes hobby-based things, because it forms part of your identity. It's like, I am a retro computer person, or I am a reader. And look, I can prove it. My house is surrounded by books. My house isn't filled with books. How do I prove to people I'm a reader? And it's easy to get your identity tied up with the things that you own and display. And it's important, I think, to separate that. And you can be an absolutely wonderful retro computer enthusiast and only have a couple computers, or none, or a few, or just one room, or whatever. Or be Paul and have them
or
all.
Just a like one iMac G4.
Right.
Yep.
Totally. Or in my case, one iMac. How are you divesting, or how have you been divesting yourself of things? Or what have you done?
Well, some of the things I gave away to local collectors. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of a network of us here in Portland. It's kind of interesting. There's a lot of retro computing interest in Portland. So, and one of the big retro YouTubers, Adrian's Digital Basement, is here in Portland. And so there are people that will be happy to accept donations of retro computing things, other collectors that will then take them and have fun with them. I heard, for instance, that I'd had an IBM PC 51, which one was the 5160 was the XT, yep. Right? That's the one that I had. I had one of those and gave it away and found out that the person that had wound up with it was completely overjoyed, had actually got the matching monitor for it, and had tricked it out with some other things and got it loaded up with some software and was just having so much fun with it. And that did my heart good, because it had just been collecting dust here for me. So yeah. I haven't sold anything on eBay. Actually, I don't think I sold anything at all on eBay in 2021. But there are some things. Carrington mentioned books. I have books. I want to keep some of my books. I don't want to keep all of my books. So there are some books that I will sell for cheap on eBay. You won't see super duper inflated prices from me like you see from some eBay sellers. And we haven't mentioned that in a while. We should mention that. If you see retro books on eBay, be careful, because sometimes you can go to Amazon or other sources and get them cheaper than the eBay seller is trying to sell them for. That's not always the case. It's not the case.
Yeah, I'll usually go on Abbey Books and look there if that's a book I'm looking for. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And now we know how to say Abbey
right.
Books.
That's
because
right.
of this research.
Because I made a phone call,
It was done. Yes. So, local collectors and eBay, but not too much eBay in 2021, maybe more in 2022. Some of the stuff, it takes a lot of energy to pack it correctly. You know, if you send somebody a retro computer, you don't want it to arrive in more pieces than it was when you sent it. Mm. And unfortunately, It seems like the people, the shipping companies who convey these things from point A to point B have gotten worse, not better, in terms of how rough they are. And maybe part of that is, well, I don't know if I can explain it. I just know that people have seem to be reporting more problems. So, man, when you pack something up to ship it from an eBay sale, that's a lot of work. So sometimes I'd rather just give something away and save myself some hassle than actually get the money for it. I guess I could Craigslist it if it's not something that I'm interested in donating.
I find it a pain to sell things locally, even though, because locally it's like the person doesn't show up, or they do show up, or now in the middle of a global pandemic, I got to hang out with somebody who wants to have a discussion. I'm like, please just take the item. It can be a hassle, like arranging it, and divesting of things is harder than acquiring things.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep. I momentarily there forgot about the COVID challenge, but you're absolutely right. You get together with people, you have to be more careful in terms of distancing and that, you know, it's like you open the trunk, you walk 10 feet away, let the person walk up, take a look at the computer. Yeah, what a pain. Anyway, I do want to do some more of that, though, because I have almost now, I did a significant reorganization, I probably mentioned that too, of the way that I store things. And that helped a lot. It made it more manageable, and where I wasn't scared I was going to die any moment from the pile of stuff falling on me. So I'm almost to the point where I'm at, you know, equilibrium. If I could just get rid of a few things and hopefully some of the bigger stuff, then I'll be in good shape.
Excellent.
So what about you, Paul?
Yeah.
2021 in retrospect, the Paul story.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it is actually hard to find the divider between 2020 and 2021. I mean, like it kind of all bled together, but, I've kind of enjoyed setting things up in this new environment that I'm in. So that's been good, but I guess it's possible that, the stuff that I've been doing just recently, which is a little bit like what you were talking about, Earl, like going through and downsizing, is that may be the thing that I feel like most characterizes my retro time. It's been a lot of fun. I've basically, transferred a bunch of stuff, here, and I've been going through it. I've been concentrating mostly on boxed software, manuals and that kind of stuff. So I haven't yet started to address any of the machines. And that's something that I think I do want to do. There are many things that I have six of that I might not even need one of, but the thing is, it's really super interesting to look at these boxes. Like, I got them for a reason. I like them. They're cool. But at the same time, like once I've sort of done the thing I wanted to do, which is to scan them and image them and sort of make sure that I can look at them later, I don't actually need the physical thing. Like, I know the physical thing would never do anything with me. It would just sit in a file cabinet. So once I've actually got that image of, whatever it is, then it might be, then I do kind of want to get it on to someone else. And I think that story about the XT is, is exactly right. I mean, there are people who really want this and want to display it and put it, put it in a line with all the other ones like it and show that. And I'm never going to have a place to do that. I'm never going to, it's not going to happen to this box if it stays with me. I'm looking forward to that too. Like letting the people who want these things, cause I do have some pretty cool things, if I do say so myself. I feel like I'm getting what I wanted to out of them. I'm scanning them, and I'm also getting a chance to flip through them and hold the box. And so I'll remember what it is. As I'm scanning it, I'm also taking photos, and part of that is that some of these are going on eBay, and so you need to take photos for that. But I'm actually photographing everything just because I kind of feel like scans are sort of lifeless in a way. But like a little, whatever, I forget what you call it. I don't know what you call it, like three-quarter angle, shots of the box and stuff like that, so you can see like the depth of it in the corners and that kind of stuff. It's that brings it to life a lot more. It's really neat to see that on a big screen. I've got the box right here, but looking at that photo of the corner of the box on the screen is really sort of like, it's effective somehow. So,
you know, there's this new thing I've been seeing on Facebook, and I don't know how people are doing it. It is like a 3D picture of something, but it's only about a 10 to 20 degree angle of rotation. But it's like, for some reason, their camera in their phone or whatever is able to take this kind of a photo, and you can drag your mouse across it and rotate it just a little bit. And I mean, it's not much, but it's enough to give it a more lifelike depth perception than just a static photo. Do you guys know anything about that, how people are doing that? Because it looks really cool. And I would think that if someone was looking at a photo of a retro computing thing that they were interested in buying, being able to drag the mouse around just a little bit, not like a full 360 kind of thing, but just get a little perspective of it might be fun.
Yeah. I've seen what you're talking about. I don't know how it's done, but it's got to be easy because of the sort of technological adeptness of the people who I've seen posting these things.
Well, I mean, maybe you take two photos at slightly different angles and it does an extrapolation or something. I'm not sure, but it's really pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that is an interesting idea. I haven't gone to that extreme. You know, I thought I was going an extra step by taking the photos and not just scanning, and we were talking before about, like, maybe I should weigh it and, you know, so I get the chemical composition. You can deduce, you know, what the paper was made of so it smells
right.
Send
it to the lab for
when reproduced. But yeah, it does seem like I was originally thinking that I would take movies of, like, me picking up the thing and holding it and, you know, opening the manuals and stuff. And then I realized, if you know, I've got 900 things, I'm not going to do that.
No, too much time. Although I did that for a programming language called Clipper, which was a D-based programming language. Clipper Summer of 87, I'd got it new in the box, and I did an unboxing. And I thought, this will probably be the most boring unboxing in the history of unboxing. Who cares about an old D-base, you know, program compiler? And the weird thing was, it had, like, I don't know, 12 views for the longest time and a couple of comments. And all of a sudden, it got posted somewhere. I don't know what happened, but the next thing I looked, it had like 1,500 views. And I thought, how did that happen? It must have been posted to like a D-base enthusiast, you know, mailing list or something like that. It just, it went viral. That was so strange. But yeah, something like that can be fun with certain things, doing an unboxing and videoing the experience and showing people, ooh, look, I got the registration card, or, you know, this particular thing came in the box, and wonder if they'll still honor that warranty, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, they're like, you know, some of the things, actually some of the things I had were still wrapped, you know, I carefully opened them up and kind of took photos of things as I took them out so that you could sort of see like how it was packed and stuff. And there are things like one of the sports games I have had a little contest where you could, like, there's like a scratch card, you could scratch it off and you could potentially win, you know, like Reebok sneakers or something. But which actually, that too I thought was weird, because somehow I considered the audience of people who played sports games and the people who actually did sports to be different. But
non-intersecting lines. Yes.
So it's not clear that, you know, these people who are playing, you know, whatever it is, the world's greatest baseball game or whatever it was, street sports, basketball, something like that, would, you know, actually want also sports shoes. Who knows?
Well, we were talking, some people give us feedback in the live chat. Some people text me instead. Verta texted to say, Facebook does the 3D thing built in. Start a post, upload a photo, click the make 3D button, and it fakes the 3D. And there's a couple of iOS apps, she says, that do the same thing. PopPic and Lucid Picks.
Fascinating.
So, turns out you just take a photo and it does like a fake 3D thing. That's why it's that small little jiggle. Take a photo on an oblique angle and it can fake it.
Huh. All right. I'm simultaneously more and less impressed.
Yeah. Sounds about right. Yeah. I think there's a thing I used to do. What is it called? I forget what the name of Tilt Shift, I think, is the term for it.
I remember that you
take photos that turns everything into something that looks like a little toy.
I mean, a little tiny.
Yeah. I should try that. Somewhere I have an app from, you know, 9 years ago or something like that.
You make it look like little tiny retro computers.
Yeah.
Charles Mangan goes to all the effort of making actual little tiny computers. You can still take a photo and fake it.
Yeah.
I'll show you, right. Charles.
But, Paul, you did quite a bit of scanning in 2021, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
It seemed like you were scanning tons of stuff.
I'm still in the middle of it. It's quite a process. You know, that's many steps. There's you know, you flux the disk and you scan the disk and you take the photos of the stuff and once you've scanned it, then you have to process it. You know, like get it into PDFs and get it up on the Internet Archive and, you know, so basically, I haven't quite figured out the pipeline. So there gets to be a big backlog, kind of like RCR episodes, but you know, so I have, my hard drive is now full of, you know, half finished scans, but yeah, I'm doing quite a lot. It's neat to see like some of the stuff that I have are, things from Apple that nobody knows about, you know, which I think is kind of neat too. Like these, you know, like Dow Jones stock reporter, you know, programs that nobody bought. I have an unopened one. I'll grab it in a second. But, you know, nobody thought it was fun enough, I guess, to open it. It's pretty huge, though. But anyway, yeah, it's neat to see these things that really didn't kind of, like, make it out into the world very much, you know. But so, anyway, that's I'm enjoying doing that, you know. And I think people will enjoy it later, being able to see, oh, yeah, look at that. There was a, you know, whatever. Tax Planner. That's another one. Another one that wasn't super popular, but has an actual Apple logo on it and stuff. Anyway, yeah. Yes, I've been doing a lot of scanning in 2021, I think is the answer to your question.
And I think you never know when something like that is going to be interesting or come in handy to somebody. I was listening to a couple of other podcasts recently where the hosts, for one reason or another, were... And yes, I do cheat on RCR sometimes and listen to other podcasts. Sorry about that. But they were talking about things that were uploaded, for instance, to BitSavers. I guess there were some documents, internal documents from Xerox that got uploaded there. And when the gentleman who wrote that recent book about kind of a fictional account, a fictionalized account the Xerox PARC story was referencing those documents on BitSavers and was coming up with new bits of information that he didn't know about. I thought that was great. I think there was a huge hoard of stuff, if I remember right, from Atari that got, you know, basically captured and was available, and people were going through it and very interested in all the company history. And what was the other thing? On another podcast, a gentleman was saying he'd actually traveled to Stanford and was taking a look. Apparently, when you had noteworthy folks that had been at Stanford doing one thing or another and they left, they had an archive of all of their working papers and various, you know, like a collection that you can actually physically come look through. And so for the research on this podcast, the host, and this was on Advent of Computing, which is an awesome show. Mm-hmm. He had gone out to Stanford and was taking a look through these things that had been collected regarding Doug Engelbart and the work that he had done. Fascinating stuff. So, I mean, archiving all of this stuff is great. I think whatever we can scan and get saved for posterity, you just never know when it could be really important, or just, you know, casual browsing for somebody just... entertainment kind of thing. I'm kind of interested that there was a Dow Jones thing for the Apple. I wonder how the Dow Jones service just in general made the money that it did. Who signed on for that? Because practically every computer that you got or any piece of software that you got had something in it about Dow Jones back in the 80s, it seems like.
Very 80s thing.
Did you guys have Dow Jones? Were you stock market day traders? Is that how you made your millions?
In Canada? Please, we didn't even have money. We would bang the rocks together.
Yeah, I mean, I guess though, you know, at least for the Apple II, that was like one of the big things, you know, one of the things that propelled it was the killer app, you know, VisiCalc, right? So we know that there was a large business clientele. You know, I didn't interact with any of them, but they did. They did, you know, education and VisiCalc users pretty much, I think, were what kept, you know, what got Apple going. So there was I have a couple of different Dow Jones things. And one of them has a little, you know, has a little information sheet on how you, you know, sign up for your account. And I think the one I have yet to open says it comes with a free, you know, a free some number of hours on during off peak time.
Yeah, and only $1,000 an hour after that.
Yeah, I don't actually know how it even works. I mean, like, I was a little bit more familiar with things like CompuServe and the source and stuff, but I assume it's kind of similar in function. But maybe it's actually just, you know, just stock information back and forth. I don't know. Could you actually trade with these packages or just monitor your portfolio?
I don't know. Maybe somebody in the chat knows.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody out there made their millions with the Dow Jones package.
We had a long time. Let's see this. I'm looking at the show notes from Drop 3 Inches, episode 11 from 2015, where we talked with Martin Hay, who had gone. We sent him on a trip to the Stanford library or the Stanford archives because they have a big Apple. Like all of Steve Jobs' stuff went there, I think, and they have a very large Apple collection. And that was pretty interesting, actually, to hear about that. They you know, like they sort of, he had to request the documents in advance. They were in some, you know, off-site location, and then he met them there, you know, and had to wear gloves, and, you know, it was all very constrained. I think he wasn't even allowed to have like a pen, you know. So I think he could like take photos of the things he wanted, but he couldn't bring anything that could accidentally mark one of the archives.
Oh, interesting.
So it was pretty involved, and you do need to know. You can't just go and see what's there, you know. You have to go, like, I want this thing from box 37B.
And they catalog it, from what I understand.
These
archives, the various folks who do this, they have a catalog that you can look through, and you can then say which boxes you want or which artifacts you want to take a look at.
Yeah, yeah. The cataloging is often just sort of by title, you know. So I mean, there's
so
a lot
not
of
be
stuff.
Possible to know. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think he was specifically. I think the thing we sent him for, this wasn't me. This was Admiral. He sent him, but looking on like what was the deal with the RFI emissions stuff that they were trying to do with the Apple III, because I think that was a big concern with the Apple III, you know, and so there's a lot of stuff that was sort of placed around it to try to keep all of the sort of like interference out. And I forget what the conclusion was, but at any rate, that was the thing. That was what M was looking for. And so we sent him on and then talked to him a little bit on that podcast episode about sort of like what the experience was like. So if you want to hear that, that's from 2015. 6 years ago, many years ago.
You guys talking about going to a reference place and asking for things by title and not necessarily knowing what you're going to get or the details of it reminds me of, I don't know if I've talked about this in the show, but not being a very smart person. As a kid, I was super into film. Like, I still am, but I was really, really, really into film, and I got into old films. And you could go to the library. So I'd bicycle over to the library, and you could check out movies to watch in the library. Like, not video cassettes or whatever, like little reel movies on 8mm or 16mm reels. And you would sit in a little cubicle, like sit at a desk, and there was a viewer, and you'd put in, sometimes it was a tape, sometimes it was a reel-to-reel thing, it was a bunch of different stuff. But I could get movies, and I'd get all these old black and white movies. I got really into old like Kurosawa films, but also just like film noir things from the 20s and 30s and 40s, just really into black and white films. So I'd go to the library, and I spent a whole summer frequently bicycling to the library, taking out films just based on, I thought it had a cool title, and I would sit at my little booth and I'd watch these videos. And near the end of this process, months of watching these movies, I discovered you could plug in headphones and listen to them, because just because a movie's in black and white doesn't mean it's a silent film. I thought all films that were black and white were silent movies. And so I just watched these films thinking, like, I guess you're supposed to just pick it up and I could follow the plot. And sometimes they'd be an actual silent film, so there'd be like little interstitial things. And sometimes it would just be like a 1940s gangster film. And I'd be like, well, I guess that's the bad guy. And they're clearly arguing and you could kind of follow the plots. And I thought all films that were black and white were silent. And I am not a smart person. Turns out you're supposed to plug in headphones. Who knew? Of course there's not going to be a speaker playing. It's a library. So.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. I went out and grabbed the, is it reversed? I don't know. Dow Jones.
Nope, Dow Jones.
News and Quotes Reporter. Still wrapped, but, you know, it is an actual Apple box. And it's thick. It's a big thing. So it's as big as my head for those not watching.
Hold up a banana to your head so we can tell how big your head is, though.
Right.
It's full of money.
Paul's head is full of money.
Actually, when I got it from the person originally, I think the person who sold it was kind of mystified that I was even interested.
Sure.
It's like, why do you want this? Okay. I will take your money and I will send it to you, but what are you going to do?
Sure.
With it?
For whatever your reason is.
And apparently what I'm going to do with it is sit on it for 6 years or whatever and eventually open it and scan it.
I think it's kind
of
cool.
Jeremy in the chat is mocking me, saying the first third of The Wizard of Oz is silent. I hear you, Jeremy. See what you did there.
All right. Let's see. Anything else we wanted to talk about, like in 2021 or plans for 2022?
I would have thought
too much about that.
I would have thought the fact that I can't go anywhere, and it's been basically there's no social stuff you can do for coming up on 2 years, 10 years, how long it's been, would have meant I would have gotten more done. So it turns out lack of time is not the problem, the thing I've been blaming all along. It might just be me. Mm. I might just be inherently lazy, and I should stop blaming lack of time. If given all the time in the world, I still might accomplish nothing. It's a bitter pill for me to swallow. Let me tell you.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I've definitely heard, I think people all have had different experiences over the last couple of years that, you know, with respect to time. I mean, like, so I have not had any particular gain in time. I mean, I work in academia and I'm actually on sabbatical right now. And so that has gained me time, but that had nothing to do with the world situation. You know, that would have anyway. But, you know, like my own job went on and was actually made somewhat more complicated. I mean, like some less travel, but it would still have continued. And I think that happened with a lot of us. But there are other people whose job didn't go on and they had all kinds of extra time. Not necessarily desired, but yeah.
I guess that's true. I wasn't one of those. The stuff that I do continued unabated. Like there's been no interruption, delay, nothing. But it is the case that like there were no restaurants to go to or cause it. Like I did some things I used to do that I wasn't doing anymore, but I apparently filled that time with, I don't know, maybe I watched a bunch of television. I really don't know where things went.
Yeah. No, it was stressful too. I mean, like the reason that you couldn't go out to the restaurants and that they were closed also could make it hard to focus.
True. That's a good point.
Well, a couple folks in the comments, I completely resonate with what they're saying. Not necessarily lack of time. Lack of energy and enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't claim lack of time because I work as a contractor limited to 40 hours a week, hard limit. So I can't work overtime even if I wanted to. So time isn't an issue there. But enthusiasm and energy, just a lot of the last year or two has been draining. Mm-hmm. And just the whole circumstance. So there have been times where I've been sitting around going, should I jump into that retro computing project that I was so excited about? Or should I sit and play a video game on my modern computer? Should I do some more stuff in Minecraft? I think I'll just do Minecraft. And I think at this point, maybe going into 2022, the thing I need to do is pivot into, because sometimes you don't have the energy to get started on something, but when you get started on something, working out is like this, I know. Mm-hmm. You get started on it, and then it gives you more energy. And so you get back into a positive cycle of, ooh, that was fun. I want to do some more of that and start to build some new habits. So if anything, I'd say that's one of my goals for 2022. Just get moving again.
If you make no changes at all, though, Earl, if you do nothing different, it won't be too long from now that Minecraft is retro. So, like, just stick with what you're doing, and this is a self-solving problem. Because when the heck did Minecraft come out? It seems like a long time ago now.
It's been a while, but you know the interesting thing about Minecraft, which totally isn't a retro topic, so we're getting in the weeds here. But
it's sort of pixelated.
Yeah.
It is very pixelated. It looks very cool looking. And they keep coming out with new versions that add entirely new genres of things to do within Minecraft. You had the Cliffs and Caves version. You had the Villagers and Pillagers version. You had lots of different waves of new functionality that came out in Minecraft to give you whole new things to explore. So they're doing their best to keep it fresh. They actually had a version come out a little bit ago here that just seemed like it messed everything up. It performed horribly on my computer. And I was kind of irritated about that. But then they came out with a point version that seems to have fixed that up because now it's snappy again. And I have a lot of fun with that. But you're right, could be retro not too long from now. So I'm just going to go with that.
In the chat, Al mentions EverQuest. It's been running since 1999. I knew it was old, but I didn't know it had been that long. That's crazy.
So is Minecraft the sort of thing where, they've updated the software, they've fixed it. But is it possible for you to choose to play the version from 5 years ago, or is that just gone once the point update is released?
I'm not sure how far back it goes, but in the version picker, in the Minecraft launcher, you can go back quite a ways.
Oh, okay.
So you can choose to play an older version, or you can choose to play the recent released version, or you can even choose to play the snapshots, which are a little bit more buggy, but they'll show you the cool new stuff that the developers are working on. Another game that I like is called Elite Dangerous, and I guess I can claim that is retro because it's a direct descendant of the Elite series of games from the 1980s.
Yeah, that's seriously old school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I never played Elite. I had a lot of friends who loved it, though. Loved Elite.
Yeah.
Someday.
Yeah, I also, like, I'm sort of vaguely familiar with it, but I never played it beyond probably just, like, starting it. You know, I probably got it from a BBS or something at some point. I now have a couple of, you know, actual boxes, but that's a modern thing, you know, that I didn't at the time.
Most of the games I played at the time I didn't have boxes for. Wonder how that worked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, how'd that happen?
I mean, that is one of the things that I was thinking about when I started off in all of this, is that, you know, like, I had all these things, but it was kind of neat to have the manual, you know, like, I'd never had the manual before. And
there are,
you know,
so many
really
games like
you
that
the disc.
That I've subsequently, later in life, seen the packaging, seen the box, and been very surprised at what it looks like. I thought, wow, I love that game. I had no idea the box would have looked like that. Like, just wasn't, not only did I just have a pirated version, I think I like never saw the retail version, never even made an attempt or saw it in a store. It's crazy. Some games I really loved, I was very surprised at the packaging.
Well, here's a pro tip, an 80s pro tip. So if you happen to go back to the 80s, you could use this pro tip.
Okay.
If you worked in computer retail back then, the markups on software were amazingly high. So your employee discount would allow you to get stuff for, you know, dimes on the dollar. Honestly, it was really cool. So I did wind up with a bunch of software that I would not have ordinarily. Like, I think when I worked at Egghead, there was this Microsoft set of development tools. It was something like $700-something, but as a software retailer, I was able to buy it for, I think, $40, something like that. So my house, and you know, we had books back then with the software that you would buy. So talk about being overwhelmed. That was, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, maybe that's not a good 80s pro tip, because it's like being a candy enthusiast and working in the candy store.
Mm.
You'd spend all of your all of your hourly proceeds on the product.
Like, I don't know if you are familiar with the game Chivalry. There was a game. You do various things. You know, it's a bunch of different games sort of embedded in one game, but it's a board game. Actually, I mean, like, when you actually have the box, there's a big play field and you have little markers and you put them down, and it's, you know, I hadn't actually even realized that until I got the thing. You know, I mean, it does sort of refers to moving ahead two spaces or whatever, you know, but there's an actual, you know, it's an actual big set. I have another one that's called Oil Barons that also comes with a huge play field where you put like markers down and stuff. I mean, like it's sort of like a jigsaw puzzle. It's in like six pieces and you assemble it and put it on your floor, and something to play at Kansas Fest next time is real. Actually,
didn't they do that with some of those strategy and simulation games too?
Yeah, like definitely
some
those
of the war games. You'd have a map,
like the SSI games. Yeah. And,
yeah, or particularly the the Avalon Hill and SSG both actually had SSG. A lot of the ones that had the markers. SSI tended to be like so SSG was Australian, and SSI is not.
Yeah, it was SSG I was actually thinking of.
But yeah, I have a lot of those, because actually those boxes are cool. I mean, like they make a nice collection. But again, you know, I'm never going to have a place to put them, and they're huge. So those are those have been the first ones that I've been kind of moving on. But I've seen a lot of them recently because of that. So okay, it's possible that we have covered the the topic already. I don't know.
Sure, why not?
I think so.
Tune in 2022 to hear what we're doing in 2022.
Or re-listen to the first episode of 2021.
Yep. Okay, so we can probably move on to listener feedback. We have I haven't been keeping up super well. That's pretty much that's another little checkbox to, you know, bingo card thing to check off. But there are a couple. So I talked a little bit about putting 128 megabytes of RAM in my SE30. Which is a ridiculous amount of RAM for an SE30. And Sean wrote in and mentioned that like one of the most useful things you can do in that situation is actually use most of it, like set aside 8 megabytes for the system and use the rest for a RAM disk. Yeah, that's a reasonable thing you could do. So if you move the system there and restart, then it's just like super fast. So I will perhaps try that. And also this is the same Sean who had the list of Macintosh network games, and I talked about how he'd sent us this Excel file, and I looked at it and it was large, and I'd commented on it, and I'd said, you know, I wasn't sure if it was actually available, and it turns out it is available. So the game spreadsheet is available on Macintosh Garden and always has been, and I just didn't know it. So do you know Macintosh Garden? Are you familiar
yes.
with the site?
Big fan of Macintosh Garden.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a. I don't exactly know how it continues to exist. I guess nobody cares to take it down. but it basically has downloadable images of all the old Mac stuff that you want. Basically, if there's something you're looking for, it's there. So, and among the things that are there are things like the network. Network games. So I've put it up on the screen so you can see it. We will have a link to it in the show notes though. So if you have a vintage Mac and you wanted to try out network games with friends, here's a large Excel file of all the things that you can do on LANs.
Does these be like local talk network games, or?
I presume so, but yeah. Oh yeah, we got an email from Jan. Episode 245, we talked about sort of like estate planning and stuff like that. And there were various things in this email, but one thing that was sort of an amusing note. So apparently Jan's also involved in the local cycling community, and some of the people in that community get some pretty outstanding machines. That it's not super uncommon for somebody to buy like a $10,000 bike. And as a sort of a side effect of this, apparently it's also not uncommon to have the people who bought the $10,000 bike report its cost to their partners being somewhat less than that. And so they have an agreement in the community basically that, if somebody passes away, then the community will go and, you know, to the surviving spouse and sort of ensure that it gets sold for its actual value and not the value that it was reported to be, have been acquired for. And I thought that was a sort of funny note. But actually, the main point of that email, I guess, was that Jan was wondering if there would be sort of like a niche, not exactly a market, but like an interest in something sort of like internet-based that you could use for a collection inventory that sort of like helps you keep track of what you have, what you might want to sell, and in particular, kind of like where a thing might go if you unexpectedly pass away. You know, like so you can sort of have a place that you can keep track of things in a place that other people can access, I guess, in a way. And was kind of curious to know, like, you know, what kind of thing should that software package do if it were to be written for this? So I don't know. That's about all the email said, and I'm not sure. You know, like, we can think about that, or if people have ideas, you know, they can write to us and suggest things. It seems like it might be interesting, and at the same time, I wonder. Well, yeah, I wonder if that feels like too much. Too private information to
there's privacy and property concerns, maybe, and but also it seems like functionality that, depending on what it had, could be really useful to people. So it's a fascinating idea. I'd seen that email in our feedback and had really thought about that, and I thought, how could you balance the concerns that you'd have with something like this with the functionality that could be very handy and make it all work? And it's still kind of chewing on that, digesting it. Other biological metaphors.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you probably don't want it to be set up in such a way that essentially people could use this as a, like, you know, here's the house to hit next.
Right.
Right. Know? Right.
But, and yeah, I mean, at the same time, yeah, it does sort of seem like maybe it shouldn't be publicly viewable. Perhaps, you know, except to like people you designate, but it would still, you know, maybe encourage you to itemize a little bit more carefully and say, like, this is a thing I borrowed this from, you know, Ted, and this should get back to Ted if I don't make it up to the, you know, return date. Okay, anyway, I think there were a couple other feedback emails, but I will leave it there, I think, and we can move on. What's next? Items of interest and news. Yeah. Okay. So, Carrington, you have the first of those.
I do. This is a link to Cult of Mac, which I don't normally like to link to because it's just such a spammy sort of site. I mean, it's got good info, but pop-ups and ads and, like, my gosh, it takes forever to load. So I preloaded it. And it talks about how the Mac, for Apple, the Macintosh Game of the Year for 2021 is Myst. So this is an article about how did a 1993 puzzle adventure become Apple's 2021 Game of the Year. One answer would be there are so few games for the Apple or for the Mac that they're this is the best you can do. But it's interesting, just a topic. Of course, if you're interested in old computers and old games, everybody knows Myst. This article goes into some detail explaining that this is an old game and where did it come from and like all the stuff that our listeners would already know. I don't think you're going to get anything out of this article if you're an RCR regular listener. But I thought it was worth commenting on that the game itself has stuck around this long. It's crazy that Cyan's game has had this length of life. Like we'll see if Minecraft can do just as well for you, Earl. But it's crazy, this game that came out in 1993. I remember playing it when it first came out. There's so many editions of it, and the real Myst and Myst 3D and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like they just keep coming back to the well and keep finding new players or old players who return to it. I have not played it through in its entirety, I think, since the very first time I played it. But I have acquired various versions of it on like GOG.com and Steam and stuff. I do keep buying it. I just don't keep going back and playing it. When I was discussing this with a couple of friends a couple of days ago, saying it came back, all of them remembered the game. These are non-real computer people, but they all knew the game. They all said they bought it, tried it. Most said they couldn't finish it because they were coming from things like King's Quest games, and it was obvious, like, you have the key or you don't have the key, or you need the broom or you need the whatever. And here, my friend Ryan described it as, like, he would just kind of walk around, and then you'd go in a lighthouse, and you'd spin some wheels, and little known to you, on the other side of the island, the light just went purple. Like, you should know that. So it was a lot of walking around and see what changes, and I just didn't have time for it. But I, on the other hand, love walking simulators. I like slow burn games. Like, the being alone in the world kind of game has always appealed to me. I like No Man's Sky for that. So the basic idea behind Myst and its execution has always really appealed to me. So I've long counted it as one of those great gaming experiences that I loved as a kid. So it's interesting that it's come back. And so it is, this game from the 90s is back and is winning awards in 2021. So that's it. I want to point out that it's still winning awards.
That is pretty insane, actually. But
it's also sad. It's sad that there isn't a better game for the Mac in 2021. Like, come on. Come on. That's great. I mean, it's a good game. It's a great game. But how different can it be that it's the game of the year? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's a totally different remake, but I don't think so. I didn't hear that. So
I wonder. So it does seem like I myself have a very sort of like soft spot for it. Because I remember just like how great it looked. I mean, like this looked amazing. And so I like it when we upgrade to our bigger, fancier monitors and we get a higher resolution render and you can actually like move around in real time and stuff like that. And, you know, it's neat to see all of that. But at the same time, somebody who hadn't experienced it like that in the past, I wonder if it is that impressive. I mean, it kind of sounds like Apple thinks it is, even to new people who didn't play it on CD.
Yep. So nostalgia's back in a big way. Probably drove a lot of sales. So game of the year, 1993 game.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Earl, you have the next thing.
I do. Speaking of 2021 retrospective, I've been watching with great interest over 2021 as Neil of RMC The Cave has been building out The Cave. This is a physical location, and my UK geography is practically non-existent, but I can tell you, because I can read, I can tell you that it is in Chalford in Gloucestershire. And I believe, don't quote me on this, but it is at the site of what used to be a mill. And
can
this
I quote,
has been,
quote your pronunciation of Gloucester?
Yeah.
I wouldn't. I wouldn't if I were you. But it's taken nearly the entire year of 2021 for this facility to be built. And you can go watch the series of videos, and I would suggest you do because it's so much fun to see how this was all built out. It is a interactive museum / hangout place is probably the best way to describe it. Lots of retro computers, retro gaming consoles, and so much care put into the layout and safety and creature comforts and presentation. It's amazing. And so finally, here toward the end of the year, they had what they call a soft opening, where they had some friends and family come in and sort of beta test the new cave. And it seemed like it all went really well. People enjoyed it. Neil was kind of watching as people interacted with each other and with the equipment that's there to see if there would be any problems, like are there spaces where it gets too cramped, or are there places where foot traffic tends to walk over the top of each other? You know, just interesting, lots of attention to detail and a whole set of bullet points. And I love the space, and I have to say, Neil is probably really lucky that I don't live near this in the UK, because I would be there every day. I would probably try and find a way to sneak in the back with my sleeping bag and just, like, stay there, because it's gorgeous. There is also a room that they've set aside to mimic, I think I mentioned this on a previous podcast, a classic computer software store. Mm-hmm. So you had lots of titles in shrink wrap on the shelves with nice title banners and that. So you walk in and you get the feel like you're in an old software store back in the day. And then there's actually a demo unit that you can walk up and play some of the games that you're seeing displayed on the shelf. And there's going to be a station there for coffee and drinks. And it just looks like such an amazing place to just go spend some time and geek out and enjoy that with other folks. So congratulations to Neil and all the folks who also participated in getting this thing set up, because it just looks absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, that would be, I would love to visit that if I'm ever anywhere near it.
Oh, if I get within hundreds of miles of there. I'm going to make sure that, now it's not open yet, as I understand it, to the public. They've got more information coming on that soon. But I would want to go there when it is open, and I would get there no matter what, if I had to walk.
Yeah. Excellent.
Very cool.
All right. Now, I think I have the next thing. So this thing that I have is, it was actually sent in as feedback by listener Bob to just sort of like let us know about this. On the, it's called Bitchin 100. It's the Model 100 wiki, which has a lot of stuff about the TRS-80, the Tandy Model 100 and 102 and so forth, the Model Ts, as they are often called. And so Steve Adolf has posted, he's done a lot of sort of hardware work on these machines, and he's posted some hardware hacks to do a 2x speed up on them. So Bob, who wrote in, said that he built the board that was designed for the 102, and the speed up is quite noticeable. There's a little bit of you have to cut a couple of traces and connect a few wires. It's not entirely trivial, but it's not super hard. And ultimately, as I understand it, it is software switchable. So on the machine, you can tell it, I want to go fast or I want it not to go fast. And so you can, the cassette port doesn't work well at, or it doesn't work, period, at 2x speed. So you have to be able to pull back the speed if you want to use the cassette. And then you can sort of push it back up when you're not using the cassette. And there's some other things that I don't think get accelerated at all, like the serial port and modem and printer ports. But it's relatively sophisticated, and it's kind of interesting. I haven't used these things quite enough yet to feel how slow they are, but I'm sure this actually makes a big difference if it's twice as fast. So, Earl, you've used these a fair bit, right? Or is that not?
The Model 100s? Yeah. Yes, that's true. And did you say Stephen Adolf?
Yeah.
Had posted this? Yeah. I think he's also the creator of the Rex, if I remember mm-hmm. right, which is one of these super duper, probably the go-to add-on that you want for a Model 100, 102 kind of computer. And I think there's a new version called the Rex Sharp. I didn't notice really the computer being dreadfully slow, like that being a challenge.
Yeah. Mm.
It seemed like when you pop that up into the editor or the terminal or our programming in BASIC, it seemed okay to me, but I still find it fascinating that they're overclocking a Model 100.
Yeah.
I think that's great.
Well, and actually, it's possible that you wouldn't notice it being slow because there's not much screen to fill. I mean,
right.
Like it doesn't have much work to do.
Right. But see, the thing is, one of the rough contemporaries, the Epson PX8.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that machine, you do notice, I think, it being slow, specifically with respect to screen redraws. It just seems to take forever. Whereas with the Model 100 has a smaller screen with, I guess I should say, it's smaller in terms of characters, but it's not smaller in terms of size. It's actually just got bigger characters and it's more crisp. And I didn't notice it being particularly slow. So maybe that's just if I worked on it enough, maybe I would. Still cool that you could do this speed up.
Yeah, I wonder if I'll try it. I might. It's conceivable. I have a Rex and a couple of other things that I, would like to use when I get into the Model 100 time, but I haven't quite. That time has not yet arrived. That'll be 2022, maybe. I have a little pile of them here. They're at least physically near me.
Oh, so. The Rex is neat because it's mm-hmm. like having multiple Model 100s mm-hmm. because you can swap out your working storage and you can swap out the option ROM that you have loaded in. So between those two capabilities, it really increases the utility of the machine.
Yeah.
Are those photos that you're showing of the speed up?
Yeah, yeah. There are sort of like instructions that have even more elaborate.
Oh, nice.
Discussion of sort of like what exactly what you cut and where you put things and how you connect it. So it looks like it's pretty doable by someone who's not more sophisticated than me. November 2021, so quite recent.
Cool.
Yeah, just last month. Wow. Awesome.
All right. So anyway, if you have a Model T and a little bit of, or maybe if you have a spare one, particularly, and a little bit of like soldering experience, this might be of interest to you.
I do have a spare one, so I might give that a shot also.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how many spares I have, but I have a number of each of them. Like there's a 100 and a 102 and a 200. The 200 is the one that I'm actually sort of like most interested in getting going, because it's actually sort of like a laptop
form. Isn't that the clamshell?
Yeah.
Model.
So I think it's better in various ways. But I do really like how when you turn on the 102, it's just like there. It's somehow it is just remarkably fast to come up. All right. Anyway, that's enough of that. Carrington, you have the next thing.
That's enough of that. I should point out I got a couple of people DMing me that Macintosh Garden is currently down. So way to go, Paul.
Oh, no.
So I just checked on Down for Everyone or Just Me, and yeah, it says it's down at the moment. So you took it
that's
out, funny, Paul.
I guess that's our fault.
You said, I can't believe it's still up. And then way to go.
But it was up like when I loaded the web browser.
That's not your fault. So it's like it's suspicious. Like you're the last one there. So yeah. Clearly suspicious.
Sorry, everybody.
So mine is a very interesting video with a very problematic title. Title is, mm-hmm. I Made My Partner Learn DOS in 2021. Now, come on. Who writes like that? I said that title as a choice of one of the news items to my girlfriend, and she laughed, snorting, and scoffed at the idea. I said, what if I made you learn like DOS or Apple stuff? She goes, yeah, go for it. So I guess it depends on your partner. But in this, I think it was much more an equal choice if you watch this. And so the concept behind this was, if somebody had no familiarity with older computers, like had never used computers back before, back when they were a command line interface. And you said, but you get somebody who's good at computers, like somebody who's good at computers, but who's used to GUIs and used to modern tech. But they got a brand new, in this case, DOS. They get a brand new IBM computer running DOS. And they want to run a particular piece of software. They get the computer, set it up from scratch, and in this case, play Burger Time. So the goal here is set up the computer and get to the point where we play Burger Time. I found the video interesting because we've recently talked about that. Like Quinn was talking about how as somebody who comes new to the Amiga today, who never used the Amiga in the past, it can be difficult to find instructions like what to do. If you don't already speak the language of the Amiga, you can struggle in a way that maybe somebody wouldn't even at the time. And so this person gets their partner to set up the computer and try to get to the point where they can play Burger Time. And if I scroll, if I kind of scrub through the video, if you look at the little thumbnail, you can see like here is, there's a manual beside her, and there's a manual, there's another manual, and there she is reading a manual, and there's a manual, and there's a manual. And it's like many, many points where she's reading and trying to figure, okay, what do I do next? But is able to do it, but you can see the struggles that even a computer nerd has today if you plop them down in front of an unfamiliar DOS only or command line only interface. So it's an interesting video to watch. Like it's a neat experiment. And she isn't dragged into it. It seems unwillingly, but there's some frustrating moments. But they do. I can say you can jump ahead and you can get to the point where you see, look, there's Burger Time on the screen. So it does end up being successful. So sorry for the spoiler there. But it's fun to watch somebody go through the whole process of, here's your new computer, here are your manuals, good luck, hope you can play a game. So it's a neat thing to watch if you're interested in the concept, which I am.
Okay. Earl, building a new Commodore 1581 drive. Yes. Various interesting things about this.
There are. I want to talk about DOS for a second, though. The video that Carrington, I was just thinking it through. I don't know. Did you watch all the way through the video?
I watched. Carrington? I jumped through it. So I've watched about 20% of the video. I just wanted to see
if it
worked.
I'm just thinking through. Man, the challenges there. Partitioning the hard drive formatting it, getting DOS on it, getting the auto exec, getting the config sys, setting up your sound card. There's so many things to step through. If you're just coming into that cold, wow. Good
what was
luck.
Interesting was this was a person who's good at computers, and you could tell. Like, wasn't daunted by the idea, okay, that's not working. How do I solve that? How do I get a manual? How do I go? If I did this experiment with family members, they will never play BurgerCon. It's never going to happen. They will never see that game. They would just give up immediately. I think people who are computer nerds today, who were computer nerds back then, and the people who are younger than us who become computer nerds, you're either drawn to this sort of thing and enjoy the, oh, it doesn't work, I wonder why, or you don't. And if you don't, I think it's hard to drag somebody into that. If somebody doesn't have an immediate love for the process and the fiddling with the computers and the feedback it gives you. If you don't love it right away, you're not going to love it. I don't know how you train somebody to dig that. I never would be able to get my non-computer friends to do that. And all my computer friends would probably love it and go, oh, this is interesting. Yes, hand me this thing from the 1970s. Let's see if I can do it. So it either appeals or it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good insight.
All my insights are great, Earl.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't disagree, but that switch does seem to be a switch, and you're either flipped on the, your switch is flipped toward, I love this kind of challenge, this is a techie fun thing, or, oh my gosh, I gotta go. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And Curtis asks in the chat whether this is, a game that needed like extra HiMem.sys settings and IRQ configs and for sound
exactly.
cards and things. I would imagine that seems like that's beyond the experiment. I mean, I don't know if it is actually something that needed special configuration like that, but that would be a little too much, I think.
Well, your sound card software, unless it used the internal PC speaker, I don't know what BurgerTime did. If it used the internal IBM PC speaker or if it uses a sound card. If it used a sound card, I assume part of the experiment wasn't fiddling with all the IRQ settings and base I/O settings. The hardware was probably already pre-set up, but you'd still have to know what IRQ is my sound blaster at or that kind of thing. Wow. Interesting.
The PC speaker was pretty bad.
It was not good. Yeah. I guess we could talk about the 1581 now.
Okay.
This is
right.
Such an interesting video. So the 1581 is one of the more popular disk drives for the Commodore series of computers. It uses the same connection type as the other drives like the 1541, 1571, but it's a 3.5 disk drive. It's not 1.44, it's 720. So those were the lower density disks. And can be a little bit harder to find, actually. But a very popular drive because it stores a bunch, stores 720K or 800K or whatever it stores on the Commodore. I don't know. I don't have one. I would like to have one. After this, I might actually try and build one. So this video is about, and by the way, Tony, thanks for sending this in. This was a link that Tony sent in to our feedback. Apparently, you can get some modern-day parts like a modern-day mainboard and some new old stock chips, perhaps, although you might have to take some of the chips from other systems to build this. But you can build your own 1581 drive, and you don't have to use the same 3.5 drive mechanism that Commodore used. You can use some of the other 3.5-inch disk drives that are out there.
Neat.
You might have a couple sitting in your junk pile if you have old PC stuff. So you put this together, and it looks like maybe there's a source for a kit of parts that you could use for the chips in that, although I wasn't 100% clear about that after watching this video, but maybe if we look in the link for the video, we could find that. One thing that I thought was fascinating was they said that you could even perhaps use a disk drive that was a 1.44 disk drive, if it had the right support for that particular model, if it could deal with the 720K diskette format. So you can 3D print an enclosure for this. For a while, and I do remember this, there were some Commodore 1581 external enclosures that were being sold empty. No guts, just the external case. And the reason being, apparently, that Commodore had taken some of the 3.5-inch mechanisms out of them and use them for the Amiga. So you had these orphaned 1581 enclosures that you could get new old stock, but that supply is exhausted. So if you want one of those, you might have to buy a 3D printed case on eBay, which apparently you can do in the $80 range, or you could 3D print your own if you've got a sufficiently sophisticated 3D printer. So you put all this together, you take this new PCB and you pop the parts on that. You connect it all with the 3.5-inch drive of your choice, assuming that it's one of the ones that this project will support. You've got yourself a quote-unquote brand new 1581 drive. Or the other option, potentially, would be to put a GoTek floppy emulator in here, and then you would have a 1581 with emulated media. Pretty cool. One of the cool things about the 1581 is that, like the 1571, it supports the burst mode of communications if you've got a Commodore 128, and that increases your speed significantly from the snail-paced 1541 drive.
Yeah, I think that would be a good use for all the kind of like junk 3.5 drives that are out there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, and so I suppose that this was this drive popular? I mean, like, or did it show up late enough in the Commodore's life that it didn't sell well?
I actually don't know how popular the 1581 was back during its actual years. By the time the 1581 came out, I'd actually moved into the PC realm and it moved away from Commodore at that point, so I don't know how many of these were sold. I know they're very popular now.
Right.
1581 will net, you know, working one maybe between $300 and $500, as he states in this video. I haven't priced them out recently. I figured that for me, they're in unobtainium territory. I don't want to spend that much for one of these. But if I could get a new drive or new-ish with perhaps some classic parts that I thought would work indefinitely, that might actually be worth it, even if it was starting to approach those same prices, because this is just so cool to have so much of it new. And as you build it, you also understand it and could maybe even troubleshoot it as well. If the physical mechanism goes bad, which I think is one of the more likely things to go bad in something like this, you might be able to find another 3.5-inch drive that you could use to replace it. So, exciting project.
Yeah.
And pretty cool that this kind of thing just keeps coming out, recreations like the recreation motherboards that they did for the Commodore 64 that you can buy and, you know, build up a new 64 from scratch. This is the disk drive equivalent of that.
I like it. The reason I was asking about kind of whether it was popular was I was just wondering if this is one of those things that people, you know, like weren't able to kind of do when they were real and new and on the market. And, you know, part of the retro, you know, the vintage computing fun is to go back and use things that you didn't have access to originally, either because you left the platform for other places or because they were too expensive or whatever. But the fact that you sort of left Commodore for other platforms, you know, that sort of, I guess I was just thinking that maybe everybody did too. I mean, like maybe there were enough people that were gone by the time the 1581 came out that it didn't sort of get out there enough that they're still findable.
That's possible. Even the Commodore 128 is kind of in that space for me. I have learned way more about the 128 these days than I ever knew back in the days when it was released.
Yeah. All right. So no comment about the channel ID.
Oh, one other comment that I'll make. The video channel for this is called RetroBits, but it's not me. It's a different RetroBits. It's a RetroBits video channel, not the RetroBits podcast. So just to avoid any confusion there. But I really like the content of this video channel. So, yeah, that's okay.
It is strange, though. another Commodore-focused RetroBits.
Yeah, a little bit peculiar, but again, very good channel content, including this particular video and lots of others.
All right. Okay, I think that is it for the items of interest and news, and we've been talking for a long time, so that's okay.
I see Carrington has labeled himself Retrobits.
Yeah, that's right. We can change our names on the on-screen little squares. So, okay, anyway, what's happening now? I think what's happening now is a word from our sponsor.
Mist. その謎は、前は誰なのか。アドベンチャーゲーム、ミスト、サターン版。ジグソーボトル、語ります。
Introducing Burger Time, the home video game where you're a chef being chased by food that constantly disagrees with you, like hot dogs that have a taste for revenge.
Burger Time!
Eggs that don't turn over easy, and pickles that are very, very sour.
Burger Time!
Now for Intellivision, coming this fall for Atari 2600.
Burger Time!
From Mattel Electronics, don't be surprised if you were on the menu.
And we're back. So the host retro computing gift idea this time is, again, something Carrington has found, fortunately for all of us. And so Carrington can tell us about it.
It's a kit computer, like the old days, the old Heath kits. There was a time, I think I've talked about it before, where I thought all kit computers were called Heath kits. I thought Heath kit wasn't a brand name. It was like the name of a thing, like when you put together, I don't know. As a kid, I wasn't really a smart person. I've grown into myself. I like this particular kit computer. I mean, basically, it's a Raspberry Pi. So you can just go get a Raspberry Pi for way cheaper than this. This is $270 on sale at the moment. Basically, you're buying yourself a Raspberry Pi. But what I like about this in particular is it's aimed at the education market. It's aimed at kids. And I think, though, it would be a really good purchase for somebody looking to buy something for a retro computing fan who skews older. So you got somebody who's really into computers, always loved computers, assembled kit computers in the 70s, maybe they're currently in their 60s or something like that. This is a super accessible way to, like, why don't we relive that idea that here's a new computer. So unlike the video I just watched, where you hand somebody an IBM and say, good luck, try to play Burger Time. This is designed to say, you're not going to know this, and we're going to walk you through all its use. And what's fun about it as a kit, it's not just, here's a Raspberry Pi. It comes with all the little pieces to make this kind of box, essentially. And comes with a monitor, comes with a breadboard, comes with a bunch of wires to connect. So it's not just about how to learn how to program the computer. It's about how do you make a computer interact with the world, and everything's included, and everything's designed as if you didn't know any of this stuff. So I like the fact that it's a Raspberry Pi and a monitor and a breadboard and a bunch of switches and a bunch of lights and a whole bunch of things in both Minecraft, talked about that earlier, and in Blocky or whatever it's called. What's that thing that people program in? Yeah, Blockly. Little coding project. So it says, here it is. Here's how to use the Raspberry Pi to interact with a button. Press a button, it lights up a light. Here's how to do some coding. Here's how to then break out into the full Raspberry Pi operating system. And it's a neat, accessible thing. It's got a battery, so it all is like a little self-contained thing. The box is designed to have a little drawer that pops out of the side, you can see there, to hold all the extra little bits, and it all folds down. So the monitor folds down like a laptop, the front folds up, and you end up with just a box that you could stick on a shelf, all fully self-contained. So I like the aesthetics of it. I like the accessibility of it. It's a little expensive for like a Raspberry Pi-based thing, but as a self-contained introduction to like Linux-based computers or Raspberry Pi or assembly computers, I think it works both for younger kids and also for older retro computer enthusiasts who go like, what the heck's a Raspberry Pi? You feel like left behind? Bingo, here you go. Nice, accessible, easy to use kit that folds up and can be stuck on a shelf. So I dig it. I dig it as an option for an actual retro computer gift, even though it's a new thing. It's the version 3 of the Piper computer kit. I don't know versions 1 and 2, but who cares? They're the past. Who cares about the past on the show? We're all about the future. Right. Piper computer kit, version 3, on sale, $270. Buy two of them for Paul for this Christmas.
Perfect. Yes. Actually, I noticed that it has the sort of like the computer in the middle of it is a Raspberry Pi A+, which I think is like nearly the oldest one, right? I mean, like, so yeah. It's a very sort of like low power requirement object. But one of the things I was thinking about is that this is something you can do with the A+, because I mean, like, I have a couple of these and I sort of feel like I can't do anything with them because they're too slow and too, you know, big and I'm not sure what to do with them, I guess. But this is a good thing to do with it, except that this comes with one. So if right. you were to get this kit, then you would now have two.
Yeah, I don't think there's a way to buy this kit and just say, I want to supply my own Raspberry Pi. You buy this as a as a kit. But I like that it comes with a breadboard. And I like that it comes with a monitor and a battery that powers the whole thing and speaker and driver for that and like the whole thing. You assemble it yourself and then you program it yourself. And it seems like a nice introduction kind of thing to building a little computer and seeing how a computer interacts with the world and how to understand logic. And I dig it. I dig it a lot.
Yeah. I like the enclosure, really. I mean, like, that is pretty cool. It's a nice way to contain it.
I mostly like that it folds up. You can see how this would, like, it all folds down and then you end up with just a cube, a little suitcase kind of, that can just be stuck on a shelf nice and clean without wires sticking all over the place.
Yep. Or you can bring it to your meetings.
Absolutely. I can see you go into Starbucks. This will be big in Portland, Earl. This is going to be big in Portland.
We'll yes, sit there, indeed.
Open it up, their Piper computer gets.
This thing looks so gadgety. I love it.
It does look very gadgety.
The drawer on the side is really just it's such a beautiful addition. More laptops should have drawers on the side.
I think they just had all this empty space. So, okay, let's stick a drawer. But I dig it because you're going to have all these little bits and bobs that you're not using during any given program. So you stick them in the drawer, self-contained. Love it.
Yeah. Or you put your Starbucks card in there or whatever.
Exactly.
All right. Excellent. All right. Well, so when you're done buying all of the Piper computer kits, you can turn your attention to eBay. And Carrington has the first eBay auction.
First eBay auction I'm picking is we're going to learn how to understand the problems with certain things. So I'm sharing my screen here, same window. It is a lovely computer. It's a Power Macintosh 8200. So this is a descendant of the 800. There was the 800, an 840 AV. I had one of those as a kid, one of the best computers ever. I've talked about how I paid a ton of money to upgrade it to an 8100. It was a huge mistake. I ruined my computer. Boo to that. This is the 8200. So you get 120 megahertz. It'd be a 601. So it's the G1, essentially. Lovely computers. But one of the things about these whole models, and this is one you can get, and it comes with the original box, although it's beat up. And it's a lovely computer. So it's being sold out of Canada, which is great. Now, the thing about these particular models, the 800s and their derivatives, is the front and back are plastic, and then the little horseshoe that goes around the middle is painted metal. So as you can imagine, those things don't end up the same color. So the big problem with buying an 800 or 840, 8100, any of these, is the front and back panels usually get incredibly yellow, but the middle part is still that perfect painted color because it's metal. So you look at something like this, and it first caught my eye because it's like, oh my goodness, it has it yellowed. When you look at the front, look at what that beautiful color, and it's only the top bay, which might have been replaced. That one is yellowed, but you finally get one that doesn't look all super yellowed. A couple of screens to show that it's working. But then we go to the side. So look at that beautiful coloring, not yellowed in the front, or so you would think. So we go to the side. Even in this, you start looking at this going like, that is beautiful. Look at these color matching. That's amazing. Because the painted parts are always the original color. They're just painted. So you look for the differences between them. And this looks great. But then you start to look at the back here and go, wait, why is that so yellow? Because cameras lie, and old Macs in particular, the cameras love to do auto white balancing and fool you. So you have to look at the back of this super yellow photo. Why is that looking so yellow here? Is that just the lighting? No, it's the camera struggling with the white balance. You always want to look for the back, and that will tell you the difference between these panels. You can see how much this actually has yellowed, unfortunately. This is the color it should be. The labels stay the same. The back is all yellow. This is not nearly as bad as most I've seen. So, but the reality is, if you buy something of this vintage, you almost certainly have to retrofit it or put up with a zebra-striped computer. It's disappointing. Yeah. This one sold out of Canada, which is nice. It's $539 Canadian, which is $4 US or whatever. It's currently on sale. It's nice they say minty, but the color differences always drive me crazy. It's such a lovely computer. I love these things. But it gets yellowed. So I thought we'd just have another reminder lesson of how to tell on these particular models whether they've yellowed or not. My second choices are, since this brought up some nostalgia, because I had that 840 AV and I loved it so much. So we go back into nostalgia land. Another thing young Carrington had was this particular thing for my Coco, the Radio Shack TRS-80 color computer Videotex cartridge. I use this to get onto CompuServe. This comes with the CompuServe guide. Hooray. It comes with the Dow Jones. We talked about that earlier. It seems very, very apropos for this. For this particular episode, I had this exact binder. I had this exact cartridge. I used this exact thing to get on CompuServe and rack up enormous bills for my parents because I was paying by the minute for the long distance call and paying for CompuServe. And by saying I'm paying for it, they were paying for it. I paid for it later and being grounded, I think. It's $25. I think in the show notes, I put something like, this is something for people who are either super optimistic that we're going to return to dial-up services, or they're super pessimistic and think we're going to return to dial-up services.
Right.
So buying this is an act of one of those two extremes. I guess it depends on how you think things are going. So what would you do with something like this? Nothing. Is it worth $25.99 Canadian, which again is 50 cents American or something? Almost certainly not. But it was a massive burst of nostalgia for me. So if you were CompuServe user on a Coco back in the day, then you and me are buddies. We probably both use the same thing. Every once in a while, an auction will just bring a wave of nostalgia for me. And this was one of those things where seeing that cartridge and seeing that binder just reminded me of my time on CompuServe. And we jump from there, our Radio Shack thing, to another Radio Shack thing that I didn't have at the time. This is a pocket dialer. So pocket tone dialer are fun, fun things. So imagine you lived in a world before there were smartphones. When you have a smartphone, like everybody, you can have a whole bunch of telephone numbers you can easily dial by just smashing your finger on somebody's face icon and bingo, it dials them. Who knows phone numbers anymore? I probably have like three phone numbers memorized, and I bet you at least one of those is incorrect. Who memorizes phone numbers? Well, back in the day, you used to have to know phone numbers if you're going to call them, unless you were a smart gadget user and you had a pocket tone dialer. So what these let you do was punch in a phone number and it would store it, and then it would play it back through a speaker, so you could just hold it up to your phone like a hacker, like a freaker doing your Rainbow Box, and you could just play the tones through the little built-in speaker into the mouthpiece of a phone to dial things. So instead of actually knowing the number, you would just look on the list of numbers. You write down like, this is Bobby is number 17. So you would just type 17 and it would play the tones of Bobby's phone number. There's tons of these things come up all the time. I like this one because it has a big flip-up list to show you what your phone numbers were. It's a $16.85 US. That's actually very expensive for tone dialer, but I like this one in particular. So my big question is, have you, Paul, Earl, did either of you ever use a tone dialer for something other than trying to get free phone calls when you were a kid? Or as an adult, if you're way older than I think you are.
No, I had a blue box for that.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
No, I never used one of these, but it is a fascinating concept because I am old enough to have had a rotary phone in the days where push-button phones, you know, touch-tone phones were available. Something like this would have been very cool.
Yeah.
But I also had a weird kind of memory where I could memorize everybody's phone number. So I really didn't need it for the memory portion of it, but it would have been a lot easier on the index finger.
But the fancy sales executives of the time, they'd have these things. There's some that have like 64 or 128 number memories. You can get ones with a bunch. This one only has 43. So, you know, that's not a lot.
Nice.
Was it 43 or 25, 30, something? I don't know. The photos are upside down. Like, yeah. It's 32. You can memorize 32 numbers. Cool. They're adorable. These things are hilarious. I remember dialing a phone, a dial tone phone. Not a dial tone phone. A rotary dial phone by just like clicking the little thing once when hit like nine by hitting nine a bunch of times.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy, man. Crazy.
Yeah, I remember thinking I was amazed that worked, you know, right. So I would do that just for fun, you know, like because the rotary thing is all it's doing is you know, very rapidly hanging it up and picking it up. So you can do that just on the switch hook, but it's very prone to errors.
Yep. When I was a kid, there was in a mall called Bayview Village in North York, there was a big display for real estate agent had this massive display and it showed all these houses, and there was a phone, and you would pick up the phone and you'd press like the button by the picture of the house you're interested in, and you hear a bunch of clicks, and it clearly was dialing out to something that would play a recording about that phone. So each house had like a unique number, and it was clearly dialing out to like an answering machine. Like that's how they solved this, was dial out to an answering machine for all of the 30 or 40 homes. But I loved it because I would simply pick the thing up and do the click, and I'd call my friends, and I would think I was the coolest nerd ever, like such a super hacker, because I was calling my friends by banging on the receiver to call my friends from that board. I just felt so cool. That was Pete Carrington. I have been downhill from that moment, to be honest. you got to know when you peak.
You know, I wonder if clicking the hook switch still actually would have that effect if you had a landline today.
I think not. My guess would be not. Everything's gone digital. So I say no.
I don't know that. I wonder. Yeah. I don't know if rotary phones work at all.
You know. Also, who's got a phone?
Yeah, somewhere I do have a, you know, I have specifically got a rotary phone. Sort of like
the one I had
when I was a kid. Well, it's not plugged into anything. No, it's sitting on a table in my office. You know.
I haven't had a landline in my home in forever. I can't remember the last time I had a landline.
Mm-hmm. I do have a landline, but I've never plugged a phone into it, I don't think. I mean, like, it's there to make my cable cheaper.
Wait.
But Jeremy in the chat mentions having a tone generator for basically the same reason I think I had one. I mean, like, I didn't actually use it, but Jeremy says that he had a tone generator when he was traveling for work in the 90s because too many hotels in the UK had rotary dial phones, and you couldn't use them to check your voicemail and stuff.
Ah, good point.
So this will generate the touch tones. Because I was thinking, I mean, like, that's what I had one of these tone generators, but it didn't have a memory. It was just a dial pad. I probably still have it somewhere, unless the battery was left in it. But and as I recall, at least initially, you had to pay like an extra fee on your phone line to be able to get touch tone recognition. You know, so it was actually more expensive to have a touch tone phone. And so I don't know exactly what purpose this would serve. You know, but I guess you could still have a rotary phone and pay the surcharge, but not. I don't know. Anyway, so I'm not exactly sure what use apart from that. The standalone non-memory holding dialer would have, but I did have one, and so I have a little nostalgia for that little brown, you know, form factor. And I didn't know how to use it to get free phone calls. So I thought the Blue Box actually required there was a different kind of tone arrangement, DTMF, or is that the regular one? I forget, but there was some different sounds that were generated by the the numbers that you needed for
the coin drop and stuff. Yeah, 2600 or whatever.
But all right, let's see. So Earl, you have the next auction.
Oh yes, could you bring that up?
I can.
So bonus points to this eBay auction for actually indicating whether or not the computer works or not, and it doesn't.
Oh,
and also it sounds like testing it was kind of exciting because when they turned it on, sparks came out of the top.
Eek.
And so they turned it off.
Oh, like on Star Trek.
You know.
All computers on Star Trek, whenever anything hits the ship, sparks come out.
That's right. Yes. Even in the 23rd century, the consoles still spark, which I think is awesome. So this computer sparks. So if that's a plus for you, you can buy it. I thought that the buy it now price, I think it's a buy it now price, right? For $250 was pretty cool for this, even though it doesn't work. Now, they don't say what kind of... Oh, by the way, Carrington, this is a Heathkit computer, so this is all computer kits.
Exactly. This combined. Is all... Yes, Heathkit computer is redundant. Heathkit just means a computer.
Obviously. That's right.
Obviously.
And so this is a computer. And I went looking for which brand of Heathkit computer it looks like, and it looks like it is a H89 model, which ran what appears to be a proprietary version of Heathkit DOS. It's a Z80 microprocessor. And the reason that I love this auction was how beautiful this computer looks. It does have some wear marks. There's something on the front of the keyboard there.
It looks heavy, man.
On the side, there's some slight wear marks. This is an all-in-one computer. It looks a little bit like a TRS-80 Model 3, maybe, or some of the other ones that were a big... It looks like a Commodore PET, actually, if Commodore PET had a disk drive to the right of the screen. Mm-hmm. But everything looked like it was in such good shape on this computer. The keyboard didn't look like it was all mangled up. All of the key print on the top of the keys looked nice and fresh and not dirty. And I bet that the intrepid collector, especially someone who was interested in Heathkit stuff, could get this and fix it up as long as it was packed properly. Talked about that earlier in the show. Packing something like this that's heavy and especially something that has a CRT is challenging. You want to make sure you do it right.
Yeah. It does look quite nice, though. It looks like it has a blue, red, and a white key. So mm-hmm. I don't know what that is. So I guess it's useful in U.S. or France. Or is that green? Maybe it's green. So maybe it's Italy. I don't know.
I have no clue what those do. Not a Heathkit collector. Don't know much about them.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting sometimes to look at the keyboards and see, the unusual ones. I'm trying to remember. Isn't there one that's something sort of like "I'm here" or something like that? There's some button like that on old terminals. Often might be here, but it's something that is in the same sort of meaning space as that. Nobody's jumping in knowing what it is. Nope. So
I don't know what that button does. I've seen it on terminals, mm-hmm. and I don't know the function.
Let's see. By the way, while we were talking about yellowing Macs, I had located another one. This is a PowerMac 7180, and it has this has the same characteristic where there's a sort of like a metal plate in the middle that's painted, and then plastic front. And this one you can see definitely there's a difference in the shade. The plastic front is all quite yellow in comparison to the rest of it, and then it's yellow again in the back where you get back to the plastic. But some of these look more like this than others, but I always think of them as looking like Homer Simpson. So, anyway. Okay. Let's see mine. I have...
Oh, I had one of these.
Yeah, so this... I sort of set this aside, and I don't know if I'm very tempted by this, but so this is it's a Ethernet micro dock for a Duo, so a Macintosh Duo. This is a super small laptop that basically all of the stuff that it had was connected via a dock. So you could put it in a standalone docking station, the Duo dock, or you could get these little. There's a bigger dock that it would sit in. Somewhere I have one. I might be able to pull it out in a second, but that it would just sort of sit on the tabletop and give you all the ports in the back. And then there are these little like micro docks that would just give you a couple of ports. And Apple had a couple of these that would give you like a disk drive connector or whatever, a ADB. Modem maybe, but there was one newer technology made one that had an Ethernet connection, and these are super obscure.
Oh really?
So, Carrington, did you actually?
Yeah, I had one of these like back when I had a Duo, like I think a 280 and then a 2300, if I remember the numbers right. And so mm-hmm. for one or both of those, I had this exact dock. It would give you ADB and Ethernet.
Yeah, it's super useful, I mean, to have Ethernet on these machines. But I guess this one, I don't know, for whatever reason, I'm always looking for it, and I rarely find it. Hmm. And I have now found this one, and it is $125 buy it now. And I debated whether to talk about it. Here I am talking
about
it.
I was a big fan of the brand. I bought a bunch of things by Newer Technology. They still exist, mm-hmm. still making computer mm-hmm. peripherals and stuff. It's cool that they've gone the distance. They made a modem that I used to use that was an acoustic coupler modem, and it strapped to a phone. It had a bunch of Velcro straps. So you would stick the cups over the earpiece and the mouthpiece, and it would strap onto it to hold it tight. And that was a newer technology, little portable modem thing I had around the same time I was using these things. And so, yeah, I remember the docks.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. I have a couple, I might have one, you know, third party micro dock, but I definitely have the micro dock and the mini dock, I think it's called, or whatever the sort of long bar that it sits in. Mm. But anyway, that was interesting. What else? Let's see. Well, actually, maybe I'll jump to this. This is a PET modem. It's an acoustic modem by Commodore that sort of fits with the PET era. So it, in fact, actually, I think it's got the IEEE 488. Is that what that is? The connector for the PET?
Yeah, that's what that looked like, that Amphenol connector on that one end.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Wow, look at that.
And I think it must be pretty rare because it's been bid up all the way to $177.50 US dollars at the moment.
Well, you can imagine, though, just forget even using it as a modem, because it's hard to use an acoustic coupler modem nowadays. It's going to be a 300 baud thing at most or whatever. But the aesthetics of this sitting beside your PET would be perfect. This is just a beautiful industrial design addition to a PET display. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And this looks in really good condition, too.
I don't feel like I've seen this. I mean, I'm not super up on PET and early Commodore stuff, but this...
I've never seen one of these.
Yeah, it seems a little unusual.
If I had a PET, though, I would absolutely love to have something like this sitting beside it with a phone. I could put that, like, just the industrial design, like, again, the look of it. I would want it just for that. I think it's absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
For those listening at home, it's beautiful.
Yeah. These things are... This is actually one of the reasons that I got... that rotary dial phone in that form factor that has an actual handset that would fit in one of these. Cause that's I mean, like you can't really like lay your iPhone on one of these or right. whatever.
One of the old Bell style handsets of the standard size that would, look at this. And the coloring, the industrial design, like Carrington was mentioning, fits in with anything else that you'd see with the PET itself or the external drives. It really is nice.
So model 8010. It ends in one day and 19 hours. So if you're watching this on the YouTube, you might have a chance to play along. But okay, let's see. Next thing I have, this is...
What?
Wonderful.
Oh my gosh.
This is actually just the first thing I came across that I put in the list. So I mean, it is a bejeweled mouse. It is like it's got little like rhinestones or something all over it.
Oh my gosh.
It's called the Jeweled Mouse by Gallery Design, and it looks like it's just a PS2 mouse that someone stuck a bunch of little like shiny objects.
But it's
on.
Not that somebody did this as like a home. It was clearly sold this way. Like the box shows it that way.
Yeah.
You are bringing the bling.
Anyway,
man. Wow.
Not a lot to say about it. It's under $20. Buy it now if you want.
If you think of that in a per bedazzle price, like that's cheap.
Yeah.
That's cheap per jangle bead or whatever they are.
Yeah. Okay. And I think, I think the last one I'm going to bring up.
Oh, you can't beat Rhinestone Mouse. Come on. What do you got?
Yeah. Well, okay. So this is... this is a Computatour, British Airways, sort of a travel magazine. Here's what I was trying to do, and I sort of failed. And actually, this turns out to I don't think this has anything to do with computers at all, except that it uses like a sort of a Micker font at the top. It's actually just sort of a British Airways travel guide. But what I was trying to do was we're going into 2022. And the calendar from 1977 matches 2022. So I was originally going to look for like computer calendars, you know, from 1977 that you could use in 2022 because all the days and dates would line up.
Oh, nice.
However, I couldn't find anything that wasn't just like, you know, a Sports Illustrated swimsuit calendar or whatever, you know, so or worse. So what I would have loved was like, you know, some sort of like IBM calendar or something like that, but didn't come across anything like that. So this is it has sort of computing in the title, and it has a sort of computer inspired font, but it is from 1977, but otherwise it is completely nonsensical, this choice.
So, that's a great idea, though, to find old calendars that where the days line up to the current year. That never occurred to me before. I mean, much more interesting to have a calendar from 1977, for instance, and talk about Star Wars coming out or whatever. Like, that's a great idea. That should be a gift idea. I like it.
Yeah, I was also thinking that something sort of like, I think actually the very first gift idea on RCR, or maybe one of the very first ones, was Carrington Years, I think, which had to do with basically faking a subscription.
Oh, that's right. And I don't know if I ever told you guys, I actually did that for a friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and so then together as what I did for his birthday gift is I got 12 magazines. It's a really niche hobby, and I put them together, and then I mailed them out once a month, and it ended up being a huge hit. So it turns out that's actually a good gift idea. Go me.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, like, I was thinking that, you know, like, you could conceivably do that for a 1977. Yeah, although the connection to the calendar is a little weak at that point. So, and the connection between the 1977, you know, British Airways prices and 2022 prices is probably also similarly weak. So what this book actually is sort of like, I think it's a way to kind of assemble an itinerary through, you know, various places you might want to go. So there are hotels in Berlin for single rooms for $15. That's not likely to translate. If you can get to Berlin safely, it's not going to be $15.
So I have a question for you, Paul. You mentioned the name of it. What is the name of that font that's used at the top? Is that iconic 1970s computer font? You said the name of the font, I think.
Oh, well, so what I said was Micr, which is M-I-C-R. That's what they used on checks in order to make character recognition possible.
Right, which I think is still used nowadays. You look at a check, it still has...
They're printed with a magnetic ink. Mm-hmm. I think the M is magnetic.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Too. But yeah, I actually am not... let's all Google it.
I don't want to Google it, I just want to ask you.
Magnetic ink character recognition.
Okay.
The Micr line. Yeah, so back before character recognition was good, this was a way that it could be printed and in a way that... magnetic reader could read it. But it's been picked up as the kind of like feature font, you know,
what computers
use. So I think it's just my mother referred to it as Micr. She worked in the Czech industry. So
good enough for me.
I don't know if that's actually the right word. But,
no, that's what I heard too. Yeah. I worked in the financial industry for a little while.
I have commented on the font number Czech. So you might want to, if your mom's looking for some feedback, the number 4 has always bugged me in that font. If you look at a check, because it's a mix of very thick and very thin numbers in the numbers on the check fonts. And it's like the top half of the numbers are very thin and the bottom half could be thin or could be thick, kind of depending on the nature of the number. Like the 8 is thin on the top, thick on the bottom. And the only one that has like a bunch of thick lines at the top is the 4. Its tall vertical line is a big thick line. And it's such a design mistake. I don't understand why that's big. And it should be just the lower part. It drives me crazy. It bugs me it bugs me now on checks. That's why I don't use checks anymore. I can't stand that 4. I'm very picky. So.
Yeah. I had a... This is only very tangentially related, but I used to write my 4s sort of with a triangle at the top, you know, the way one would think of writing a 4. And it turned out that it's pretty hard to distinguish between that and a 9.
And a 9. No, I do the 2 lines.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, so I worked, this was sort of late high school and then into college a little bit, at a data entry job where it was basically like typing in legal decisions. And there, they, like, part of what I was typing up was a markup. It was essentially like, you know, in the legal decision, some case would be, it would have some reference, you know, to some other case. And so whoever I was working for had marked up in pen, you know, like, you know, insert here a reference to this case number and then back out. And they were very careful about writing their 4s with, you know, like disconnected like that, because it had to look different from a 9. So since then, I've always been... basically always written my 4s not as a triangle, because I'm always in my head trying to keep it distinguished from 9.
So, yeah. Anyway. A similar thing happened to me when somebody mocked a teacher in junior high or something. said my, when I wrote a 5, I was clearly just writing an S, and that's not what the number 5 is supposed to look like. It's not supposed to be just an S. And it just like made me change the way I do number 5s now. And since that time, since I was like 8 or whatever, it's because a teacher just said, that's not how you write a 5, but okay, I'll change. And whoever that teacher is scarred me enough that I now do my 5s differently, where I do the, it's kind of starting from the top left, I go down a little hook, and then I draw a straight line on the top. So it makes it clearly a 5 versus just an S. All that extra work, that teacher has caused me so much extra work. Teachers.
That's like a horizon with a sedia, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So, but at least it's clearly a 5 now. So.
Yeah.
I think there's an academic paper to be had there.
Absolutely.
Font choices through childhood trauma.
Yeah. His childhood trauma and why he has problems with 4s and 5s.
I do want to say, though, there's a genius idea to try and get a physical calendar for one of the years that matches our
year. Fantastic idea,
Paul. I've done that.
Nice.
Yeah, I've done that electronically on systems that are not Y2K compliant. You just go back and you find a year that has the same date versus day of the week match as the current year that you're in, and you know, put one of those in. Like now I know that for 2022, I can do 1977 for that, and it'll work.
The reality is, there's somebody should steal that idea and just do it. You could sell these things. Like you'd sell 1977 ones right now that clearly allude to what's cool happening on the day, but it would match our days. But it would be like Star Wars is coming out. This like, just these things, all 1977 stuff, but and just every year, pick a cool year and do it. Like totally, those would sell. I would buy them. So.
1983 is also a match, I think. So ooh. Both of those are sort of like, you know, good years.
Nice. They were good years.
So. Yeah. Unlike 2022. So we'd like to...
Wait, who wants a 2022 calendar? Please.
Yeah. All right.
In the just to jump back in, Santo in the chat, it was, he says it's the here is key was on early terminals. We were wondering what the name of that key is. It's the here is.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. That's so that I think I forget now what I thought it was, but it's something like I'm here is what I was guessing, and here is, yeah, that sounds right. Something that didn't really feel quite fluent in in English. You know, it's like what?
Wait.
I don't know.
Here I am, yeah. H.
Yeah. It's funny that exact thing popped into my head. It's like I wasn't quite sure how I was gonna work that in. But.
I just say it. Because I know you're thinking exactly what I'm thinking.
All right. And congratulations to everybody who got
that reference.
Okay. So I guess that's enough eBay for
that's
now.
Enough. That's enough of all of this.
Yeah. So we can move to closing discussions, closing thoughts, further thoughts on what you want to do in 2022, that sort of thing. So Carrington, I guess you're first.
I want to play text adventures that are not Zork Zero. So I'm very motivated to finish Zork Zero, to get past it so I can conclude it and then get on to more text adventures. I'm very keen to play more text adventures. Speaking of retro things that I've bought and that I love, my new record player in the back there, that's a stacker, so I can put more than one record I adore. And I recently picked up and was today listening to, I got new copies of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So I've got the old 2 records, but there's new editions of them and they're massive thick books. But I also just picked up the Dirk Gently ones. So I got Dirk Gently's things in these huge editions that are lovely. The art in them is amazing and they're huge 2-pound things and they're great. So if you're a fan of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or Dirk Gently and you have vinyl stuff, you should seek out the new editions of them because they're crazily beautiful. So highly recommended.
So Dirk Gently was also a radio drama?
Yes. Yeah, really good one. Both that one and Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul or whatever. So both radio dramas and both really good.
I did not know that.
Yep.
I sort of assumed that Hitchhiker's Guide went... Because I think it...
Hitchhiker's went from the, radio drama to other things. Right. Dirk Gently went from book to full cast radio drama. That's amazing. So yeah, totally that's worth listening to.
Cool. Yeah. But the radio drama was preceded the book, right?
Is in that Hitchhikers.
Not, yeah.
But not Dirk Gently.
Yeah, got it. Very cool.
Yep.
All right. Earl, any closing thoughts?
I guess I don't have any parting shots except to wish everybody happy holidays, a great 2022. Stay safe, have fun, keep the faith. Retrocompute.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, I guess I sort of feel like I've already sort of covered all the closing thoughts I had in the opening. So, Carrington, you were mentioning that you were saying that you wanted to play something, some game that wasn't Zork Zero.
Yes.
But it was a text adventure game. I have. So one of the things I scanned was it was a Magnetic Scrolls.
I hear such good things about those, and I want to play them.
Yeah. So this one was called The Pawn, and
Pond with a D or Pong with a G.
Pawn. Neither. The Pawn, P-A-W-N, like in chess.
That makes more sense. I'm like, the Pong, like the smell? Isn't this a British game? Oh, it's called the Pawn. It's a scratch and sniff game from Britain.
Oh, no. Yeah. Anyway, so on the back, I would grab it, but it's probably not worth it. But on the back, it has nice little graphical screenshots, and, you know, it shows it's a sort of graphic. You know, you type at the bottom, and there's you know, illustrations or whatever. But on the little sticker, it says, you know, this is the Apple II version, text only. So okay. The box has like all these nice like graphic screens and whatever, and when you actually play it, it's just text only. Text adventure.
I like text adventures that are text only. I'm totally okay with that.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, I'm sure it's fine, but it felt a little jarring to have the combination of the box, and then when you try it out, it's like, oh well, by the way, you don't recognize graphics.
You should imagine these graphics while you play.
Yeah. Say 2600, you right? Remember the 2600 boxes that had fantastic graphics?
Yeah, graphics in front of those were amazing. Yeah, 2600 right. Boxes and carts have fantastic graphics.
Yeah, I think didn't we discover that the same artist or something did like some of the early Atari stuff and the like early Apple manuals? I think
yeah.
The covers of the Apple things really do look Atari. Like,
so, or vice versa,
could be. Who knows? Though I think it's versa vice. You know? Yeah. Like I think Atari was first.
But,
anyway, that's all. So I guess we can leave it at that and say that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And if you wish, there are reviews on iTunes waiting to be read. And until next time,
Retro Compute.
Weighs 200 pounds, it's got 158 lights, it had burned for 6,000 years, that ball, but in just a few short seconds, it will denote 1977.